members of the church, education is not merely a good idea, it's a commandment. We are to learn of things both in heaven and in the earth and under the earth, things which have been, things which are, things which must shortly come to pass, things which are at home, things which are abroad.
Welcome to Insights. I'm Marilee Stallings. Our guest today is Dr. Larry Baxter, professor from the Chemical Engineering Department at Brigham Young University. Larry, it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's get started. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in chemical engineering.
I grew up in very, very small communities. I tell people, and it's true, that in the dorm room or building that I moved into when I came to school had more people in it than most of the hometowns that I'd lived in up until that point. So I had no idea what an engineer was. I started off as a chemistry major, and one day someone explained to me what chemical engineering was, and it sounded like all the funnest and most enjoyable parts of chemistry to me. So I switched, and I have never regretted that decision. I thoroughly enjoy engineering and chemical engineering.
Well, that's great. Now, your research area, it says on your BYU website, the faculty, little blurb about you. It says that your research area is sustainable energy. Tell us what that means.
That's actually a very good question. So sustainable energy means using energy in a way that meets our current needs as well as preserves resources for future generations. It's actually a definition that came out from a United Nations report that was published many, many years ago by a Norwegian prime minister who became Norwegian prime minister, one of the first woman prime minister of Norway. And I think that's the most functional definition of sustainability. So that's different, for example, than energy independence, which would, in political terms, would mean to remove our independence or remove our dependence on foreign sources of energy, which would be especially petroleum. And it's also different than renewable energy. So the renewable energy advocates are less perhaps less concerned about meeting current demands, which would require for the foreseeable future continued use of fossil energy. But they share commonly with sustainability the intent to preserve resources for future generations. So,
now, what energy sources then are available to us today?
There's a lot of ways you can divide them. One useful way is to divide them into sustainable, probably more useful into renewable energy and fossil energy or non-renewable energies. That's not as clear-cut as it could be. Some things that are not strictly renewable are sustainable almost indefinitely, like nuclear energy. So there are some major sources of energy that don't fall easily into those categories. But so in fossil energy, in the United States and worldwide, about 85% of the energy that we use is comes from fossil resources.
So that's coal, oil, natural gas.
Coal, oil, natural gas being the principal ones, right? And that's a huge fraction of energy. There are, in certain isolated locations, exceptions to that 85% rule. France, for example, uses a lot of nuclear energy. There are a few other countries that are outside of that bound. But no matter how you look at it, whether it's developed countries, underdeveloped countries, about 85% of the total energy, 85% comes through a combustion process, and almost all of the combustion processes are fossil-based. So
like the electricity that we use and...
So electricity is a little bit of an exception. So specifically for electricity, in the United States, it's not an exception. A little over half of our electricity comes from coal. Nearly 90% in the state of Utah comes from coal. But nationwide, about 55%, 50 to 55% comes from coal.
So those two little windmills at the point of the mountain are kind of just this little drop in the bucket.
they're good facilities for trying to learn how to use renewable energy more effectively, but they contribute very, very little to the overall energy picture in Utah, or wind in general, very little. So about 6% of total electrical power comes from some sort of renewable resource, And most of that actually comes from biomass, so and hydropower from dams.
So what are the major problems that we have with these energy sources?
The problems have always been about the same, and that is that our energy production is an environmental concern. And a lot of people perhaps aren't aware of this, but since 1970, roughly, if you were to poll people, I do this with students all the time, most people would say that our environment's getting worse and worse and worse. It actually has improved steadily since 1970. We have a considerably better environmental conditions now than we did in the late 60s and early 70s. But we're also producing more and more energy. And as a great tribute to the hard work of a lot of people, regulators, technicians, technologists, corporations, we have substantially increased the amount of energy that we're producing while reducing the environmental impact fairly significantly over the 40 years since the environmental regulations first started to become significant. But almost all of those environmental impacts are associated with trace materials that have really no value to us from an energy standpoint. They just come with, for example, the sulfur and the nitrogen and the coal that are responsible for producing NOx and SOx, contribute very little to the energy of the fuel, but they're just an inherent part of the fuel, and we have to deal with those impurities and cleaning them up. We're in a new world now with carbon dioxide, so the conversion of carbon to carbon dioxide and hydrogen to water is the heart and soul of a combustion process. And the CO2 emission, which leads to global warming, greenhouse gas emissions in general, is going to be a much, much more difficult problem to solve. So it's been a huge contribution to be able to remove these impurities from fuels and be able to clean up the environment. But by comparison, that's a relatively simple problem compared to CO2 removal or dealing with the CO2 emission impacts.
So it's important then to come up with a solution to these problems, because ultimately what are the consequences?
So the consequences are pretty easily seen actually in fairly short term but nevertheless very memorable events in the United States. So in 2000, for example, starting in 2000 to 2001, everyone will remember, Californians in particular will remember, that they had an electrical power shortage as they were deregulating their electrical power market. We now know that that was largely artificially created by corporations taking advantage of those laws, but nevertheless was very real at the time. And power rates and costs went very, very high. The economy suffered enormously. Those are the consequences of having either poorly generated, poorly distributed, or very expensive power. And most of us don't really think about power costs or energy costs because for the most part they've been low for a long, long time. But if they increase rapidly and if we don't do things smartly, they have the potential of compromising our economy, of costing jobs, of doing a lot of things. And that had a very severe impact in California. It changed public attitudes dramatically. So at the time, they did a survey, and even in California, which is one of the most anti-nuclear states in the country, more than half of the people said that they would support the operation of additional nuclear power plants if they could be brought online in time to address this power shortage.
Wow.
So the impacts are yards. So energy in general represents somewhere between 6 and 10% of the overall economy. But the rest of the economy, most of the rest of the economy, depends upon that energy fairly significantly. So increasing energy costs has an impact on the economy that's far greater than its actual fraction of the economy itself because of those trickle-down effects in almost everything else that we produce.
I remember a couple of years ago when gasoline prices just got higher and higher and higher until finally people stopped driving their cars.
So when they finally do get high enough, people do stop driving. But for the most part, gasoline is what the economists would call an inelastic commodity. Most people drive almost the same amount, almost independent of what gasoline prices are, and that makes it very difficult to regulate through a price type of a thing.
So. Mm-hmm. So there are consequences. So this sustainable energy really is an important subject to address.
It's regarded by many as the most important technical challenge that we face this century. So,
really?
That statement has come from the National Academy of Sciences and of Engineers and from many well-known scientists around the world. Now, century has just started. There may be a lot of other very important technical issues that we face, but at least it's that important in many people's eyes that it's one of the primary goals of the addressing and solving this issue is one of the major, major challenges in the country.
So. Well, especially not only our country, but other countries, too, where you have China, which is really booming right now, and they have a real demand for energy there. India.
And in fact, in the growth of China, India, other third world nations, Brazil kind of hides in the noise, but it's also growing rapidly. The growth of all of those countries and the associated, if you look at global climate change, the associated contributions of that growth to climate change will dwarf the relatively steady growth that the rest of the world is also anticipating having, but at much slower rates than those countries. So I often tell students that to solve this problem globally is going to require a level of international cooperation that is unprecedented, literally unprecedented in the globe. So if you go back, probably the most dramatic example of international cooperation in our memories was during World War II, when countries really were suffering for one another and cooperating in two polar opponents. But nevertheless, there was a huge amount of cooperation among countries for a common goal at that time. I think the sustainable energy problem is going to require, first of all, one goal, trying to get to a sustainable environment, but it's going to require a level of cooperation that exceeds even what was happening then if we're really going to solve this problem. Because it's in no single country's interest to solve this problem alone. All they do is compromise their economy, cripple their own industry at the expense of everyone else. And so you can't look to most politicians, at least people who are currently serving in office for leadership, because most of them are understandably focused on their national interests, not global interests. You're not going to find in any of the normal places the kind of leadership that you need to solve this problem. I think it's going to have to come from a ground from the public in many different areas, insisting that we do this together. So,
interesting concept. Thank you for tuning in to the Mormon Channel. You're listening to Insights. Our guest today is Dr. Larry Baxter from Brigham Young University, and our topic is sustainable energy. In Salt Lake City, we get what is called an inversion in the valley, in the Salt Lake Valley. It gets really cold, and the air doesn't move, and the pollutants get trapped in the valley. How does your research address problems like this?
So it's important to realize that people didn't create this inversion. The inversions were here long before there was any significant population in the valley.
That's true.
They always have been. So it's in some ways we have in Utah and along the Wasatch Front in particular, we are blessed to live in one of the most spectacular places in the entire country. And I've lived in a lot of spectacular places in the country. I was born in Jackson, Wyoming, but this is as fine a place as any place you could live. But one of the consequences of our unique geography here is this inversion that we get to suffer through in the winter times. So during the times of the inversion, the best things we can do is try to decrease to the extent possible the emissions of anything that is potentially hazardous in the environment. So for the most part, in practical terms, that would mean not using fireplaces, trying to avoid driving, and in general trying to avoid significant amounts of emissions until the wind comes up and clears the air and breaks the inversion down so that we can breathe freely again. It's a serious problem, actually. Utah is distinguished in many ways, but one of the ways we're distinguished is we fairly frequently have some of the worst air in the country in the wintertime. Because of this inversion layer. That's not something that I think that this beautiful state wants to be known for. We need to try to find ways to solve those problems. So some of the significant things are is, as I mentioned, fireplaces are actually far worse than most people realize. There's most fireplaces. I'm going to get in trouble with the fireplace industry. So there are fireplaces that you can get that are, for the most part, gas-fired that are very clean. But a wood-burning fireplace, and especially a coal-burning fireplace, is one of the most environmentally damaging things that an individual household could employ. So automobiles are also significant. Any one automobile is not particularly problematic, but the number of them that we have on the road is the problem. So public transportation, not using fireplaces during those times, or at least not using fireplaces that aren't outfitted with pollution controls, would be the things that individuals could do that are most significant. Corporations have a lot more leverage. There are some corporations that by their nature have large emissions of pollutants. And for example, in Utah County, when Geneva was here, there's a very measurable impact of the emissions from Geneva on the health of people, particularly during inversion layers. That actually became those studies that were done by Arden Pope at Brigham Young University became the basis of a fairly major set of regulations on emissions from major sources like that. And so the research that I do is more geared toward these large installations, so what we call large point sources of pollutants, where we can add systems to those sources that will significantly reduce their impact on air quality and on global climate change. So.
Now, you sent me a paper, and you've already mentioned it. I have to give the name of this paper, Cryogenic Carbon Capture Status. It is a very scientific paper, but we talked a little bit about it earlier, that 85% of U.S. and global energy does come from fossil fuels, and that this contributes to global climate change. Do you have any examples of this problem?
So take coal-fired power plants as the example. So coal-fired power plants contribute roughly one-third of the total CO2 emissions in the United States. They contribute less than one-third of the total energy. They can contribute over half of the electricity, but they contribute very little of, for example, transportation energy and things. So in terms of total energy, coal-fired power plants contribute 20 to 25% of the total energy, but a third of the CO2 emissions. And the technology that we've developed is actually reasonably simple technology, and it has a lot of advantage. But the way it works is, any global climate change technology on any coal-fired power plant is somehow going to have to separate the CO2 from the rest of the gases that are coming out of a power plant, mostly nitrogen, and then capture that CO2 and store it someplace for long, long periods of time, basically indefinitely. And there are several ways that you can do that. All of them are very expensive, both in terms of energy and in terms of dollars. So to be specific about that, if you were to build two power plants with the same output, one with the CO2 capture and one without the CO2 capture, the one with the CO2 capture would have about a 30% lower efficiency, overall efficiency, in converting the fuel to electricity. And it would cost about 80% more to produce the power from that power plant. So those are very large numbers. So to put a CO2 capture technology onto a coal-fired power plant consumes almost a third of the output of the power plant.
Which, of course, then would send rates up.
So it sends rates up for two reasons. You've got to operate that, which is where the 80% comes from. So the cost of power generation would increase about 80% for two new power plants. And the amount of power that you produce per unit coal would decrease by 27 to 29%. So those are very large impacts. The technology that we've developed would cut both of those numbers in half, roughly, or actually more than in half. So it's, as I tell the people I work with sometimes, this is still a lot of energy that we're consuming, and it's still a lot of money that we're talking about. But by comparison to the alternatives, it's a much, much better solution. So we would – we actually just finished this analysis again with – and we've had this reviewed by international corporations that are expert in this area, by national labs, by other people. And they all agree that this technology could be built and the cost of power would increase by no more than 30 to 35%, and the power demand, that is the consumption of power by this technology, would be less than half that of the competing technologies. So it's a pretty major deal for us.
That is. And, you know, the cryogenic,
I
know cryogenic means really, really cold.
That's right. So the way the technology works is basically we just cool the gases coming out of the power plant down to the point that the CO2 condenses out of the gas, and then we warm them back up again. When the CO2 condenses, it actually condenses in a way that's called desublimation. It goes directly from the gas phase to a solid. It doesn't actually form a liquid. So it forms a solid CO2, which we then collect from the gases, separate them, and then we warm them both back up again, and we pressurize the CO2 to get it ready to store underground. And then by the time it gets back to room temperature and pressurized, it'll be a liquid again. But the process basically just cools down the flue gas, separates this until we can separate the CO2 from the rest of the gas, warms it back up again, and then we have them separated and we can pump the CO2 off to other places. So the cryogenic refers to that cooling process, and carbon capture means capturing of the CO2 in the flue gas. I guess this might be more technical than you want to hear, but to put this in contrast, one of the other alternatives that people are pursuing significantly is to fire the coal-fired power plant only with oxygen. So if you only put oxygen into the power plant, you get only CO2 and water coming out the back end of the power plant, and you can condense the water out of the gas fairly easily, and then you have a fairly pure CO2 stream, which you can then pressurize and use the same way. The process by which you purify the air going into the power plant, the most commercially viable process, is a cryogenic process where you cool the air down to the point where you separate nitrogen from oxygen, and then you use the oxygen to fire the power plant. That process has to go to a much colder temperature. It is far more energy intensive for technical reasons. So this is kind of the same process, but put at the back end of the power plant instead of the front end of the power plant. It forms a solid CO2 instead of a liquid oxygen, and at least initially a solid CO2. And it just turns out, for lots of technical reasons, that it's much, much easier to separate the CO2 from the nitrogen in the exhaust of the power plant than it is to separate oxygen from nitrogen in the air that's going into a power plant.
And so then this extra CO2 would just be captured and stored underground?
So there are a lot of things you can do with CO2. Some of the ones that make the most sense would be you can use CO2, for example, to enhance oil production from oil wells. They flood oil wells with CO2, and that enhances the recovery of oil from the oil well. There are lots of other similar things you can do with CO2. You can pump it into unminable coal seams, and it displaces methane, so you can produce methane from the coal in the seams. But if you look on a global basis, so locally, all of those things might make sense. So the first few people that build a technology like this might find somebody who's actually going to use the CO2 in some productive way. But the total amount of CO2 that needs to be captured if we're going to do anything about climate change completely overwhelms the capacity of oil wells or unminable coal seams or almost any other use that you can think of for CO2. And so the great majority of that CO2 is probably going to end up being stored in what they call saline aquifers, so saltwater aquifers under the ground, typically 2 kilometers or so, a little over a mile under the ground. You just pump the CO2 into the saltwater aquifer, and over a period of time, it will absorb into the water and become something like soda pop. But but that takes a long time for that to happen, and eventually you can store it there basically forever. And there are people that are looking in detail at that process all over the country. Some of the leaders of that are actually here in Utah. At the University of Utah, they have a very large program where they're looking at CO2 injection in saltwater aquifers. When you look at the total process, though, about 90% of the cost of the process and probably more than 90% of the – well, far more than 90% of the energy and probably 98% of the technical risk is really associated with separating the CO2 from the nitrogen. The injection of CO2 into a saline aquifer is certainly needs a lot of research, but it's a much more mature, much nearer term technology than the separation process. So.
Wow. You're listening to Insights on the Mormon Channel. We're discussing sustainable energy with Dr. Larry Baxter, professor of chemical engineering at Brigham Young University. Why is renewable energy so hard to develop compared to fossil energy?
So I'm a strong renewable energy advocate. In fact, worldwide, I'm probably better known for my work on renewable energies generally, biomass in particular, than for anything else that we've done. But the reality is this. The way that renewable energies are available to us is so inconsistent with the way that we use energy. And for the most part, at least thus far, has proven to be so much more expensive than the way that we produce energy from fossil fuels right now, that renewable energies have, for the most part, been only niche markets. So there's one big exception to that, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But things like solar and wind and biomass, yeah, it's very difficult to get them to compete with things like coal, natural gas, and oil, at least the way that we do the economics for energy right now. One exception is hydropower. Hydropower is a renewable power. So this is building dams on rivers and generating electricity from them. Every projection for hydropower, that every realistic projection for hydropower I've seen in the United States and in most developed countries shows that the amount of hydropower in the future is actually going to decrease, not increase. And that has a lot to do with the effects of these dams on fish populations and fish migration routes and other kinds of things. And actually, having overbuilt, for example, in the Columbia River Basin, the dams there actually interfere with one another. They have them spaced too closely together so that one dam actually backs water up into the tail of the next dam. So if and when they rebuild those dams, they'll put them further apart, and the amount of hydropower will generate will probably decrease, not increase. So hydropower is the one renewable energy that actually competes very well. Hydropower is actually cheaper than coal or any other form of electricity, but there's just not much more of that available than what we have right now. In fact, most people would say we're going to decrease that. So the other kinds of renewable energies tend to share these kinds of characteristics. If you look at wind and solar, for example, those are the two that most people think about. First of all, they're not dispatchable. What does that mean? That means when we need more energy, we can't ask the wind to blow harder, and we can't ask the sun to shine brighter. And we, in fact, can't control when the wind's going to blow or when the sun's going to shine. And that makes the energy much less useful. So it turns out in every part of the United States, at nighttime, we have far, far more energy-generating capacity than we need because we're not using very much energy, and we still have all these power plants that have to operate 24 hours a day. They operate at a lower level at night, but they can't turn them off at night, so they just turn them down at night. So at nighttime, for example, we have far, far more energy than we need. If the wind blows at nighttime and starts turning a windmill, it just adds to what's already a saturated market of energy that we can't do anything. So the energy that we really desperately need anywhere in the country is during the peak hours, when typically that's going to be for places that have air conditioning. It's going to be in the early afternoons of a hot summer day. That's when every available power generating system in the grid is usually online and generating power in order to help support air conditioning and other major power-consuming devices that are on the grid. So if you can't ask for the power when you need it, then you're just hoping that the wind's going to blow and the sun's going to shine when you need it, and that makes the energy much more difficult to use. Secondly is most of the places where we would like to put windmills and large solar arrays are not very closely located to population centers, and so we have a distribution problem. So the windmills are going to be out in remote areas for the most part. The solar arrays will be in fairly remote areas, and you have to distribute that power into the cities. We don't build large high-voltage grids through remote areas because there's nobody living there and there's no reason to build them for the most part in those areas. So most of the installations for power suffer from the problem of being able to transport their power or transmit their power from where it's being generated to where it's going to be used. And finally is the cost. The costs of, if you look at real costs without government subsidies and other kinds of things, the costs of almost all the renewable energies are considerably higher than the costs of generating energy from fossil sources. Now, part of that is because people say we don't really include all of the costs in fossil sources. So, you know, we don't include, for example, the costs of global climate change in charging people for fossil sources. We don't have a carbon tax or some equivalent thing to that. But even if you consider that, even in, by most analyses, even if you consider all of the externalities, as they're called, these other costs that aren't rolled into the cost of fossil energy, still renewable energies are pretty expensive. So having said all that, almost everybody would say we need as much renewable energy as we can conceivably put on the grid. But there's a real false the people who say that there's a competition between renewable energy and fossil energy don't understand the energy industry. The world is going to need all of the renewable energy you can get, and even after you have developed all of that renewable energy, we're still far, far short of the increased amount of energy that we're going to need to produce, both within developed countries and especially within developing countries. So there really isn't so much of a competition between them as there is a need to get all of them to be reliable and effective and efficient and affordable, so to sustain the kind of lifestyles that most people need.
We want to use our computers.
Computers are – home computers are actually a fairly significant source of energy consumption, and most people don't recognize how much computer centers – how much energy computer centers use, but computer centers are very large consumers of energy. In fact, that's part of the reason you probably know that they're building a major computer center in Utah just outside of Lehi. And part of the reason for that decision is that Utah has reliable and low-cost electricity available to power that system. And building the same system in California, the energy costs in California, retail energy – well, let's say residential energy costs in California are sometimes 6 to 7 times as high as they – well, generation costs are 6 to 7 times as high as they are in Utah. So
I don't think I'm going to move very soon.
Well, but that points out that even though the energy costs can be much, much higher in some locations, they're still a small part of anybody's budget. And that's part of the problem is that we just are not aware enough of energy because it doesn't really impact our personal budget very much. Most people's power bills are almost transparent to them. They don't know how much they're paying for power and they don't really care. It's just such a small number compared to what they spend on most other things that they just don't think about it. And that's part of the problem of getting people to think seriously about the way we use energy and trying to conserve or be smarter about how we do those things.
A little earlier you mentioned that France uses a lot of nuclear energy. What are the major issues associated with that power source?
Nuclear energy is a very widely misunderstood energy issue in the United States, actually all over the world. Most people, I think, have visions of Chernobyl in their mind, and because of those visions of Chernobyl, they're very skeptical about, maybe afraid of, nuclear energy, and that's pretty understandable. I've been to the regions in and around and the power plant of Chernobyl many, many times. I led for over a decade a major effort in cleaning up the efforts around Chernobyl. But the real issue with nuclear power is safety is a fairly minor issue. The realistic projection of the amount of people whose lives could be impacted from a safety standpoint or the potential number of deaths from nuclear power is far, far less than, for example, from coal power. Just to put that in practical terms, in the United States, on average, one or two coal miners die a week. They don't die one a week. They die in groups of disasters. But if you were to average it out over time, roughly one to two miners die a week just mining the coal. And if the nuclear industry had a record that was anything remotely similar to that, it would be shut down in a heartbeat. But the impacts of coal and coal mining, of coal production, of coal-fired power plants, on the health of people and the pollution that comes from coal are all much, much larger than those of nuclear power for a well-designed, well-built nuclear power plant. And the way that we design and build nuclear power plants in any Western nation is you can never eliminate, and if you think you have eliminated the possibility of an accident, then you're in trouble. But you should always be watching for and making sure that you can eliminate it. But the chances of an accident like Chernobyl happening anywhere in the United States and any existing or future nuclear power plant are so remote that that's just not a rational fear. But there are issues with nuclear power. But safety is probably not the one we should be the most concerned about. In my view, the two most significant issues with nuclear power are, first, the waste that it produces. And the issue with the waste is we know how to – we can get the waste. We can manage the waste and we can store it somewhere. But the waste from the way that we produce nuclear power in the United States is going to be around for a very, very long time.
And it's not like the CO2 that just kind of dissipates into the saline solution.
Right. And in fact, well, the CO2 is actually also around for a long time, but it's around for tens to maybe 100 years. But the waste from a nuclear power plant is potentially going to be lethal for hundreds of thousands of years if you look at the highest level waste. That's actually a problem we can solve. We have the technology to reduce that length of time that the waste is going to be dangerous from hundreds of thousands, actually approaching a million years, 250,000 years roughly, so between 250,000 to a million years, some people would say, to 100 years, which is still a long time. But that's a huge reduction. The problem is that the technology that would do that, the reprocessing technology where we could use that waste and put that same material back into an appropriate nuclear power plant and use it as fuel, is the same technology that someone would use to extract that material from the waste and use it for building nuclear weapons, for example, or other weapons of mass destruction. And in the United States, our policy has been that we won't do that because the proliferation risk of the weapons we view as a bigger risk than the risk from the pollution. We can solve either one of those problems individually. We could solve the proliferation problem if we didn't care about the waste, and we could solve the waste problem if we didn't care about the proliferation. Yeah. But solving them both is a real challenge. But there is significant progress being made on solving them both. There are designs that are – no one's built these power plants yet, but people have designed power plants that would largely address both of those issues. So nuclear power is widely misunderstood. It's a great potential power source for electrical power production. And the public needs to be better informed about what the real risks are, what the real issues are to make decisions. The public needs to make the decision. But it would be best if the public made the decision on the basis of well-understood principles of what the real risks are and what they're deciding. Right now, I think the decisions are mostly based upon things that are really not issues with nuclear power, but they're kind of emotional responses to the way people think about nuclear power.
Well, and I think you made a very good point that if you took the comparison between coal energy plants and nuclear energy plants, I think that would be a very good thing to do, is to get that knowledge of what's the impact of either one, rather than just say this one, I don't want to use it because of. But to do that comparison, do a little study.
Those comparisons have been done many, many times. And in all cases, the way that we currently use coal – so there's a big difference between the way that coal would be used if you were to build a new power plant and the way that most coal is used right now. Most of the power plants that burn coal are – the average age in the United States of coal-fired power plants is about 40 years. Those are very old power plants. They were built in an era that was long before a lot of the regulations that we have right now. Many of them have been retrofitted with improvements. But if you were to build a brand new coal-fired power plant, it really is a very clean and the new mining techniques are much safer than they have been in the past. But if you look at the way that coal is actually used right now, it undeniably has significant environmental and health impacts in at least in some regions around where the coal is being used. And those are, by almost any measure, more significant than realistically estimated impacts from nuclear power plants would be. But let me say that it's just like renewables versus fossils. It's really not a contest between nuclear and coal. If we want to solve the energy problem, we're going to need nuclear and we're going to need coal and we're going to continue to use natural gas and we're going to need all the renewables we have, and we still won't have solved the problem from a sustainability standpoint.
Wow.
So it's not that we have to choose one of these. The answer is all of the above, and then still a lot of very good engineering. And the most difficult part is probably changes in lifestyle in order to get to a point where we can really say that we're sustainable. So,
well, let's make a little bit of a shift to the future. What major changes in the energy portfolio will occur in the future?
Some things are inevitable. So, for example, people can debate wildly at what time, but I serve on a national committee that studies these things and writes opinions for Congress all the time. And we just finished a paper which said that sometime in the next 20 to 30 years, oil is going to have become much more difficult to produce than it is right now. CO2 is in any by every rigorous scientific measure, CO2 emission and global climate change is a reality. The science of global climate change has gotten more certain every year, even though the public opinion has become more skeptical every year since about 2002 or 2003. There are a lot more people worried about global climate change in 2002 and through 2003 than there are now, but in the United States anyway. But the science of the climate change has actually gotten better every year. So the question in all of these things really becomes, are we an advanced enough society that we can recognize and address these issues and manage them cleverly and manage these transitions away from oil and manage a transition where we're not producing climate change? Or are we going to let the world do it to us? That is, are we just going to get into the crisis and then face it when it's a crisis, when we have a much less
Options when you're in a crisis.
Right, where things become very, very much more stressed. And I'm hopeful that the former is true, that we can say we see the problem. We are smart enough to find solutions to this problem. We're going to develop and implement those solutions, and we're going to try to manage this transition away from oil, for example, away from CO2 emission. It doesn't actually necessarily mean away from coal. The oil will run out because of a resource limitation. The coal won't run out because of a resource limitation. Every realistic projection, even those that show renewable energy increasing in the future, also show in absolute terms coal increasing in the future. The percentage of coal generation, many projections show decreasing, but the amount of coal generation in terms of the amount of energy being generated from coal is increasing. It's just that other things are increasing faster, so the percentage starts to decrease. So we need to deal with the climate change issues, find smart, clever, effective, cost-effective, energy-effective solutions to those. We need to deal with the issues with oil. Natural gas actually has a fairly long future ahead of it, and for the most part, natural gas is less environmentally aggressive than coal or oil, or probably nuclear by most measures. And so natural gas will become a major issue, continue to be a major issue in the future, but it too will need CO2 climate change type of mitigation technologies. And renewables will become more important. All of those things are inevitable. Probably within the lifetimes of most students in school right now. And the real question becomes, are we going to be smart, not be afraid of them, but look them head on, address the issues head on, and say we can solve these problems. We just need to get focused. We need to be effective in our research and development and our regulation and address the issues that way. Or are we going to wring our hands until we're in a crisis, in which case the issues will address themselves and we'll be responding rather than trying to manage them.
This is Insights on the Mormon Channel. Our topic is all about sustainable energy, and our guest is Dr. Larry Baxter. I have a couple of more questions that we want to ask before we wrap up. In what ways do policies of energy sustainability, energy security, and renewable energy reinforce each other, and in what ways do they conflict?
So the formal policies of the U.S. government, for the most part, have addressed energy security issues. And if you're trying to solve an energy security problem, then what you're saying is that we want to decrease our reliance on imported oil into this country. That's the real energy security issue. That would mean that we would want to transition, for example, I'll take one of the government policies that might make some sense in that regard. So we in this country now pay a very large amount of tax to support the conversion of ethanol, of corn to ethanol. By most measures, that conversion is, by some measures, it doesn't make any sense in any regard. But if it makes any sense, we're taking what we're trying to do is displace transportation fuel, which is where ethanol goes to, so that we don't import so much foreign oil. From a sustainability standpoint, that's actually not such a great program for a lot of reasons. Increasing agriculture by the massive amount that you have to increase in order to convert that ethanol to transportation fuel has huge environmental impacts. And those environmental impacts, by most measures, are more severe than the environmental impacts associated with using petroleum. The actual energy balance is very controversial in that, but at least some credible people say that we actually consume more fossil energy trying to make the ethanol than we're going to save by displacing oil. But the fossil energy that we consume is to a large extent, or at least to some extent, going to be based on natural gas and things that are produced in the United States. And the fossil energy that we avoid consuming is imported oil. So from an energy security standpoint, that might still make sense, even though it doesn't make any sense from an energy balance type of standpoint.
And economically, I don't think it makes a whole heck of a lot of sense either.
And economically, it's pretty hard to justify. But there are other techniques that use biomass that make a lot of sense. That's just not one of the better ones. That's not been one of the best things the government's done with energy policy, in my view. So in general, if you're looking at energy security, then what you're trying to do is find ways to displace the amount of oil that we import, even if that represents consuming more energy from sources that are domestic. If you're looking at sustainability, that doesn't make any sense. What you want to do is decrease total energy consumption and the impacts of that energy globally, not necessarily looking at such a nationalistic picture. So some of the policies that you would develop under energy security would be not just inconsistent with, but in some ways opposed to the policies that you would develop if you were trying to do energy sustainability or renewability. Usually the public hears those terms and they think they're all the same thing, but they're actually very different, and the decisions that you would make differ fairly significantly depending on what your goal is.
Final question. What can individuals do to address energy issues most effectively?
So there's actually a huge amount we can do, both as individuals and as a society. So I'll go through a list, but at the end of the list is going to be the most difficult thing to do. So some of the things are very obvious. First of all, to inform ourselves about where energy really goes. So it's great, for example, to turn lights off in your house. So that does save energy, and that's an important thing to do. But most people might not realize that turning lights off is, for example, far less effective than not using the air conditioner or not using the furnace or something like that. Air conditioning consumes far, far more energy. And in general, space heating consumes far more energy in a home than lighting usually does in most homes. But lighting is still a significant energy consumption. It's great to replace lights with more efficient lights and do those kinds of things. But to inform yourself about where the energy consumption is really going, so in your home, space heating, HVAC things in general are usually the largest consumers of energy. In developing societies, cooking is also a major source of energy consumption, but it's a fairly minor source of energy consumption in our society. The amount of energy you use for your microwave or your stove or your oven is a fairly small fraction of what you use, but there too you can make some choices. The other big thing is actually outside the home, but part of your domestic life is driving your car. And anything that we can do to drive less or to drive smarter, smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles or to carpool or to use public transportation has a very big impact on our personal energy consumption. A lot of people, unfortunately, think about it like you know, if I take the bus, I can save this much CO2 generation, but that's nothing compared to the amount that the country is generating. So it really doesn't make any difference. And they'd be mostly right. That is, what any one individual does is not going to make any difference nationally. But the right way to think about it is not to say how much of an impact am I making nationally. It's to say how much of an impact am I making relative to my personal energy consumption. And so a few other things that at least professional people can do is it's surprising that airfare or that air transportation can be a very large fraction of your personal energy consumption. So people who travel frequently on airplanes, if they can take fewer airplane trips and do more conferencing over the internet or with the telephone, that makes actually a big impact on that. Most people would not recognize how much air travel adds to the CO2 footprint or the energy footprint of individuals. So as a society, we could look at other things. So what we need to do is adapt as much renewable energy as we can. We need to do as much conservation as we can. When we've done those things, we need to do mitigation of CO2 emission through technologies like the one that we briefly talked about today. But realistically, when we've done all of those things, we still haven't met the target. And at the end of the day, for individuals and for society, we need to step up to the plate and say our lifestyles are too much focused on consumption and not focused nearly enough on stewardship. And my father actually once told me of a conversation he had with – he for a while worked as a liaison between the Forest Service. He worked as a forest ranger and the Native American tribes. And he was talking to one of the chiefs, and the chief said, "Your people are very different than my people." And he asked them to explain in what ways are they different. And he said, "It appears to me that in your society, the people who consume the most are the most respected, the ones with the biggest houses and the biggest cars and the people who just consume the most resources." He said, "In my society, it's the people who return the most to society who are the most respected." And I personally think that for the great majority of people, this isn't true of every family. If you're living at true poverty levels, this statement wouldn't be true. But for the great majority of Americans, a sufficiently articulate person could convince them, and I am almost certain that this is true, that consuming more resources, i.e. spending more money, is not going to lead to greater happiness in their life. Our economy tells us the other story. Businesses want you to buy more stuff and collect more stuff, but that's not really what's going to make us happy. And if our goal in this life is to be happy, which I think most people's ultimate goal is, becoming better stewards of the resources we have is actually a fairly easy thing for us to do. But it will be a major change in Western societies, in all societies actually, to move out of this resource consumption mindset into more of a stewardship mindset. But that is going to have to happen. And it's one of these things that will either happen because we choose to make it happen, or it will be forced upon us by environmental responses to the things that we're doing. And I think that the former is a much more pleasant experience than the latter. I agree entirely with what the scriptures tell us about there being more than enough resource on this earth to support our life. That doesn't mean that wanton use of those resources is justified by the scriptures. And in this particular case, I hope I'm not misinterpreting the scriptures, but the Lord spoke very specifically about this issue in the 59th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, almost as if he was talking about this interview today. And in that section of the Doctrine and Covenants, he talks about the resources that are available, but then in three verses, he summarizes what to me is the wisest way forward in trying to manage our resources. So it says, "Yea, all things which come of the earth and the season thereof are made for the benefit and use of man, both to please the eye and to gladden the heart, yea, for food and for raiment, for taste and for smell, to strengthen the body and to enliven the soul." Then the Lord in this verse, the 20th verse of the 59th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, says this, And it pleaseth God that he hath given all these things unto man, for unto this end were they made, to be used with judgment, not to excess, and neither by extortion. And if we think of our management of our natural resources in that light, I think the Lord is telling us to do everything we can to be good stewards of the resources that we've been given, to pass them on to succeeding generations undamaged and useful for them as well. And that, to me, is the scriptural imperative for this type of research and this type of work.
Excellent. Dr. Baxter, thank you so much for being with us today on Insights. This has really been illuminating for me and has made me think about some of the things that I do in my own home. You can keep on exploring and discovering new ideas at radio.lds.org, where you can listen to individual episodes or subscribe to receive podcasts of new episodes as they come available. You've been listening to Insights on the Mormon Channel. I'm Marilee Stallings.